Have you ever looked at the ramp at a military airfield and wondered just how old some of those jets actually are? I'm Tower, and this is ATs on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about something that affects the biggest military alliance on the planet, and if you've been paying attention to defense headlines, you already know the clock is ticking. NATO countries are in the middle of what might be the largest fighter fleet replacement cycle since the Cold War, and the reasons go well beyond the obvious. Today's segment is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. So here's what you need to know. Across the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, dozens of member nations are flying fighters that were designed in the 1970s and 80s. We're talking about airframes like the F-16 Fighting Falcon, the Eurofighter Typhoon in its earlier blocks, French Mirage 2000 variants, and in some Eastern European countries, even Soviet-era MiG-29s that were inherited after the fall of the Berlin Wall. These jets were world-class in their time. Some of them still are in upgraded form. But metal gets tired, avionics fall behind, and the threat environment has changed dramatically. Let me put it in terms a general aviation pilot can appreciate. You know what it's like to fly an older airframe? You love it, you maintain it, but there comes a point where the cost of keeping it current starts to exceed the value of what it can do for you. Now multiply that by hundreds of aircraft across 32 allied nations, and you start to see the scale of the problem NATO is facing. The headline doesn't tell the whole story, though. This isn't just about old airplanes needing replacement. It's about what the next generation of air warfare actually looks like. And that picture has shifted fast. The conflict in Ukraine has been a massive wake-up call for European defense planners. Air superiority, which NATO has enjoyed essentially unchallenged since the 1990s, is no longer guaranteed. Russian integrated air defense systems, long-range missile technology, and electronic warfare capabilities have proven far more capable than many analysts expected. The lesson is clear. If you want to control the sky in a contested environment, you need platforms that can survive in it. And a lot of what's sitting on NATO ramps right now was not designed for that kind of fight. So what are countries actually buying? The biggest program by far is the F-35 Lightning II, built by Lockheed Martin. This is the Joint Strike Fighter, a fifth-generation stealth platform that's become the backbone of NATO's modernization strategy. As of right now, more than a dozen NATO members have either taken delivery of or placed orders for the F-35. That includes traditional operators like the United States, the United Kingdom, and the Netherlands, but also newer buyers like Poland, Finland, Belgium, Denmark, and Germany. Germany's decision is particularly interesting. For decades, the Luftwaffe operated the Tornado, a swing-wing strike aircraft that first flew in the 1970s. Berlin initially resisted the F-35, favoring European-built alternatives, but the need to maintain NATO's nuclear sharing mission, where certain European allies carry American nuclear weapons as a deterrent, pushed Germany toward the Lightning II because it's the only Western fighter currently certified for that role. That's a detail that gets lost in the broader headlines, but it tells you a lot about how intertwined these procurement decisions are with alliance strategy. Then there's the European side of the equation. France and Germany are co-leading the Future Combat Air System, known by its acronym FCAs. This is supposed to be a sixth-generation platform, meaning it goes beyond stealth into things like artificial intelligence-assisted decision-making, loyal wingman drones flying alongside manned fighters, and networked combat clouds where every asset in the battle space shares data in real time. The United Kingdom, Italy, and Japan are working on a similar program called the Global Combat Air Program, or GCAP, formerly known as Tempest. Both of these programs are aiming for initial operational capability sometime in the mid-2040s. Now, if you're doing the math, that's roughly 20 years from now. And that's the core tension in this whole story. The jets NATO needs to replace are aging out now. The jets that are supposed to replace them in the long run won't be ready for two decades. The F-35 is the bridge, but it's an expensive bridge. Each airframe costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $80 to $100 million, depending on the variant, and that's before you factor in sustainment, training, infrastructure, and weapons integration. For smaller NATO members, the cost is staggering. Countries like the Czech Republic, Romania, and the Baltic states are trying to modernize their air forces on defense budgets that, until very recently, were well below the NATO guideline of 2% of gross domestic product. The war in Ukraine changed the political calculus overnight. Suddenly, defense spending that was seen as excessive became urgent. Poland, for example, has pushed its defense budget above 4% of GDP and is building one of the most capable air forces in Europe from almost a standing start. they've ordered F-35 as Korean-built F-A-50 Golden Eagles for training and light combat, and Apache attack helicopters. It's a remarkable transformation, but buying the jet is only part of the equation. This affects you if you think about what it takes to actually operate a modern fighter squadron. You need trained pilots, and NATO has a pilot shortage that mirrors what we're seeing in the civilian world. You need maintainers who can work on stealth codings, advanced avionics, and software-defined systems. You need ranges and airspace for training, and in crowded European skies, that's not a trivial problem. You need hardened shelters and dispersal bases because the old model of concentrating everything at one or two major airfields is exactly what long-range precision missiles are designed to exploit. There's also a fascinating industrial dimension to this. The defense industrial base in Europe atrophied after the Cold War. Production lines slowed, skilled workers retired, and supply chains were optimized for efficiency rather than resilience. Sound familiar? It should, because we saw the same thing happen in commercial aviation. Now, nations are trying to ramp production back up while simultaneously competing for a limited pool of components, rare earth materials, and manufacturing capacity. Lockheed Martin has been working to increase F-35 production rates, but even with a target of around 156 aircraft per year, the backlog stretches well into the next decade. Let me bring this back to something a general aviation pilot can connect with. The technologies being developed for these next-generation fighters don't stay in the military world forever. Heads-up display technology, GPS navigation, synthetic vision, composite airframe construction, all of these started in military programs and eventually made their way into the cockpits we fly. The sensor fusion concepts in the F-35, where the airplane takes data from radar, infrared sensors, electronic warfare systems, and data links and presents it to the pilot as a single integrated picture that's conceptually not far from what Garmin is doing with their latest integrated flight decks. The military pushes the envelope, and civilian aviation follows, sometimes a decade later, sometimes two, but it follows. The drone component is worth watching too. Nearly every one of these next-generation fighter programs includes an unmanned element. Collaborative combat aircraft, or loyal wingmen, are designed to fly alongside manned fighters, carrying sensors or weapons, absorbing risk that you don't want to put a human pilot into. The United States Air Force has its Collaborative Combat Aircraft Program. Australia has the MQ-28 Ghostbat. The UK is developing similar systems under its GCAP umbrella. The implications for autonomy in aviation are enormous, and they will eventually ripple into how we think about unmanned systems in civilian airspace. One more thing worth noting. NATO interoperability is a word you hear a lot in defense circles, but it has real meaning here. When allied nations fly the same aircraft, or at least aircraft that can talk to each other, the alliance gets stronger. When everyone is operating different legacy types with incompatible communications and data systems, coordination in a real fight becomes exponentially harder. The push toward common platforms like the F-35 isn't just about getting the best airplane, it's about making sure that a Danish F-35 can seamlessly share targeting data with a Norwegian one, and that both of them can plug into an American airborne early warning aircraft or a Polish ground-based radar. That kind of integration is what turns a collection of national air forces into an actual alliance capability. So where does this leave us? NATO is spending more on air power than at any point since the fall of the Soviet Union. The old jets are reaching the end of their structural lives. The new jets are coming, but not fast enough for everyone. And the strategic environment that drove this urgency, a land war in Europe, long-range missile threats, and peer-level air defense systems, isn't going away anytime soon. This one was sourced from reporting by Simple Flying, and it's a story worth following as these procurement decisions play out over the next several years. That's your ATIS brief for today. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Tower. Fly safe out there.